Welcome to Close Up Radio, where our hosts, Doug Llewellyn and Jim Masters, bring you the amazing stories of people who answered the call to unlock their potential and taken control of their own success with authenticity, creativity, persistence, and resilience. Close Up Radio special guests share their knowledge and wisdom so you, the listener, can live the most empowered life possible. Close Up Radio. And now, here's today's host, Doug Llewellyn.
Well, thank you so much. Welcome back, everybody. Welcome back. We're glad to have you back with us. We're also glad to welcome Mandy Frager back with us today. She was with us last week for an amazing conversation, and we're going to continue it today because there's much more to her story. If you didn't hear her last week, let me just explain that she is a highly sought-after licensed professional counselor and a behavioral specialist who focuses on comprehensive range of energy psychology. That's part of her story. She's not your typical counselor. She points out being in the rare position of gaining experience early on with the first generation of energy psychology leaders in the field. She got involved. She learned. And she has over 20 years of experience, making her a master in the art of using energy therapeutic techniques with her clients. She also has the opportunity and had the opportunity of teaching these techniques to much more seasoned clinicians. She knows this field very well, and she's more than just a counselor, but that's really what she calls herself. She's a licensed professional counselor. So I tell you what, we're going to go right to Mandy. She's based in Pittsburgh, where it's a beautiful day today, and rekindle our conversation with her about what she did last week, what she talked about, because she was talking about her work as a counselor. So let me welcome you back, Mandy. How are you? And let me ask you if you could recap a little bit for anyone who missed the show, your work as a counselor, kind of in brief, I guess, because we did it extensively last week, right?
Yeah. Hi. Good morning. Good afternoon to everybody out there listening. Yes, last week I was happy to do a show, and I really focused on energy psychology techniques last week and my background and how I come to learn to use them and how I use them with populations that I work with in my clinical practice. And for those of you who might not know what energy psychology techniques are, they're a collective of mind-body approaches. And you may be using some of those techniques and not know it. I have a lot of counselors that sometimes approach me and say, well, I'm doing this, but what's energy psychology? I said, you got it. That's one of the tools in that toolbox. So energy psychology techniques, I explained last week, have a lot of research behind them. They're very effective. They work really quickly compared to other techniques in the behavioral health sciences and the mental health field. So that was a really exciting show to talk about those and the gains that I've seen in the clientele that I work with. And this week I hope to expand on that and talk a little bit about autism spectrum disorder.
Well, I think that's great, and we're going to do that. Let me just ask you one other question about what are the typical kinds of clients you treat as a counselor? When they come to you, what do they need help in primarily?
Sure. A lot of people seek me out because of my autism spectrum disorder experience. So I have either the family members, parents, guardians, or the identified persons themselves who I work with. So that's a big part of my population currently. I also see a lot of people who are looking to improve their lifestyle. You know, they might come into sessions and feel like they have clinical anxiety, for example. And really, you know, we just need to tweak some lifestyle changes. So I also work with peak performance, which, again, getting better in any aspect. More specifically, I do work with athletes and mindset with that and with the energy psychology techniques. Again, another subpopulation, a really specific niche, but it's sort of underutilized, in my opinion. There's a lot to do with that, with a real specific mindset issue for athletes and definitely other things that they struggle with that we're just not talking about. I mean, in the past few years, we've seen, you know, a lot of professional athletes come forward about their mental health and things that they've struggled with, and they're not the only ones. I'll say that. There's many people out there that we need to normalize the stress that athletes are under also in many areas of their life.
That's very interesting. So obviously you work with a lot of adults, but obviously you work with kids too. Am I right?
Yes.
There are kids who suffer from these issues.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But you brought it up. Explain to me autism spectrum disorder. There are many, I'm sure, who don't understand really what that is. How do you explain it?
Yeah, this term, autism spectrum disorder, is the new term from the, I'm saying new, but it's relatively new because it's been changed from the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which is the manual of that clinicians, like mental health clinicians, use to diagnose people. And we used to call this autism. Asperger's fell under this category, pervasive developmental disorder. So a lot of people are a little bit confused with the language today. But this languaging changed, it's been almost 10 years. But why I think some of the old terms have stuck around is because the kids that were first diagnosed when we were really getting good at identifying autism, it's been about 20 years, 20, 25. Mm-hmm. So those kids were in the, you know, old diagnostic language. Regardless, the criteria generally that will that are needed to meet the criteria for autism spectrum disorder are deficits in either socialization, well, all of the above, socialization, communication, and behaviors. And so if we think about communication, that's almost everything we do, hence socialization falls, you know, in line with that. And then behaviors can result from not having, you know, the correct communication or deficits in communication and poor socialization. So it really does affect all areas of life. And it's a very broad diagnosis, but when we're looking at how to diagnose it, there are very specific behaviors sometimes that are present for kids. And again, as a diagnostician myself, I know what questions to ask to get to the bottom of, you know, what is this behavior really? Is this really something that can be called autism spectrum disorder, or are we looking at something else?
Let me ask you, when children are diagnosed with this, I'm just wondering, is it often because it's been picked up by teachers in their schools, be it kindergarten or, you know, early mm-hmm. on, or have the parents picked up on it and not realized it? How
That's
would you
a good question.
That?
Yeah, this has really evolved. Back in the day, a lot of schools were picking it up first and saying, you know, I think that maybe there's a learning issue, or we're seeing some behaviors, maybe an assessment would be warranted. And parents, so I would say teachers and parents back in the day. Today, we have way more psychoeducation with our primary care physicians and pediatricians. So I think a lot of screening tools are being done at the pediatric level, which is great. And parents. Mm-hmm. Parents are the ones saying, you know, I think maybe there's just not something that's on, or, you know, I'm struggling with this behavior. Is this typical development? And then they're going to their PCP. So I think the diagnosis is happening earlier and earlier, which is good. And there are assessments devised that, again, clinical diagnosticians can use to diagnose as early as age one or two. So early intervention has really come along. Mm-hmm.
Was it PCD you said? They go to their PCD? What is that?
PCP, their primary care physician.
Ah,
so their general
okay,
doctor, their family doctor.
Yeah, got it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, got it. Another thing is, do parents, the kids who suffer from this, have the parents often suffered from it themselves, or is that not necessarily the case?
The research is pointing in the direction that this is a genetic disorder, and there's some environmental factors, but there is a genetic component to this. So what I have seen is a lot of parents will, and because I do see parents too, of these kids, and they will describe either, you know, certain anxieties within themselves or identify with certain behaviors that their child exhibits that, oh, you know, I kind of did that when I was younger, or I thought in that way, or I know where they're coming from with this because, you know, I did this or my husband did this. So there's, I think, a lot of insight that parents have when they're really thinking about this, but there is an emotional process even with getting the diagnosis and acknowledging what it is, and being able to come out of sort of emotional mind and get down to business and figure out what we need to do to give the child the skills that they need. So one of my clients, you know, always calls it the smart brain, right? There's a, we call it the emotional mind and the rational mind. A lot of clinicians use that term, you know,
yeah.
But they call it their smart brain. So, you know, once we can harness, you know, the parents can harness their smart brains, they do start, they will start turning and thinking about, you know, wow, this does look similar to something that I've done or, you know, spouse has done. And, you know, they draw the conclusion sometimes themselves.
So how do you actually go about treating, you know, people who are affected with ASD? That's another term for it, autism
mm-hmm.
spectrum
mm-hmm.
disorder. How do you treat it?
Mm-hmm. That's a loaded question. How much time do we have? Really, the leading researched modality for this population across the board, across the spectrum and range of impairments is ABA, Applied Behavior Analysis. I might have mentioned that last week. I'm not sure. But really, this is another umbrella term for a lot of different tools that are based on behavior, what comes before behavior, and what comes immediately following, and how do we make changes before behavior happens rather than after in a reactive way, but how do we harness the child's motivation? You know, why are they doing something? What are they willing to do instead of the behavior? You know, how can we reinforce to obtain the correct behavior or desired behavior rather than punish after the fact or not know what to do when a behavior, you know, is too far gone or out of control, so to speak. So ABA and behavior modification tools work really well. I call myself a radical behaviorist. I think that was in my bio here. It's definitely on my profile on LinkedIn. But what I mean by that, it's not something, you know, like so crazy, but more so that I'm really affixed in this theory. And really human behavior comes down to, you know, just a couple principles, and motivation is one of the key. I just saw on TV, I think that there's a new TV show out, and it looks like a cop show. I can't remember what it's called, but it looks like there's a leading male role there, and, you know, he's playing detective, but he's a behaviorist, I think, is the gist of the show. So they're like, wow, you know, you can solve all these cases, because there is a predictability factor in choices when you look at motivation. So it really does work well. And why it works so well, in my opinion, with this population is because it's very straightforward, and there's rules surrounding whatever tool you're using under this umbrella of ABA. So the child knows what to expect. You know, the adult knows what to expect. If I do this, then this will happen. And this is a little bit of a controlled environment to be able to teach new skills. Granted, the real world doesn't work like that, but we're talking about teaching skills to this population, and then we graduate out into the real world in a systematic way and try to teach them how to have some flexibility when things don't go according to plan.
How early do you pick this up in kids? Is it, I mean, at what age generally would it be?
Like I mentioned earlier, it can be diagnosed as early as 1 to 2 years. So if we're seeing developmental delays, the earliest usually is, you know, not responding to social cues. Mm-hmm. Parents who have had older children sometimes are quicker to pick up that, hey, this is different. You know, this child isn't as responsive to me as an infant. You know, they might be inconsolable. They might not make eye contact. They might not engage in, you know, reciprocity. Like if I smile at a baby, then the baby smiles back. They may have a difficulty with sleep. They might have different eating patterns. And by no means will one of these behaviors constitute a diagnosis. So anybody out there who's thinking, oh, my child's having sleep problems through the night, that does not mean that they are diagnosed with this. But there are differences in development, or the, you know, really a parent's intuition sometimes, just something's not right. And it can never hurt to ask or inquire to that general practitioner or to the pediatrician, you know, this is the behavior I'm seeing. Even parents out there, even if it sounds like, I'm not sure, should I know this? You know, does this kid sleep? Are they supposed to sleep in this pattern? I don't never had a newborn before. Ask anyway. It can't hurt to ask. So please speak up if you notice something that doesn't seem quite right to you. And yeah, there's a lot of screening tools out there now, again, that PCPs can do, and definitely full diagnostic evaluations can be conducted.
That's very interesting indeed. For the older kids who you work with, you know, school-age kids, kids who are in first, second, third grade, or maybe even more, maybe even older, do you think social media is having any impact on causing kids' communication skills to decline?
Yes. And let me explain a little bit about this. So I do work with a lot of kids who are not diagnosed. And let me just go back to the ASD population for a minute. I do work with all ages. So I mentioned earlier that the first round of kids was really getting diagnosed, or they were getting diagnosed about 20 years ago, 25 years ago. So those kids that have aged out are now in their 20s. And 30s. So I do have a host of young adults that I'm working with too in that age. And the ones that are diagnosed ASD versus the ones that aren't, I'm going to say in the 20-somethings. I'm going to even make it older than your question you asked about younger kids. But yes, social media has been a real challenge for this population and for a few reasons. When we talk about communication, I think a lot of people just think that communication is getting your meaning across. Can I hear what somebody's thought is and be able to respond to it? But there's a lot more to communication than just that. There's social communication, and you would think social media is really social, and that should be helping our social communication. But in a lot of ways, the way that it's designed, it doesn't allow for a lot of opportunities and experiences that we who are in the older generations and had a lot more face-to-face interaction had the opportunity to engage in. So for example, the face-to-face communication, as simple as that probably seems to you and I, that when you talk to people in person, how you have a conversation and what happens when there's a conflict and you need to problem solve in a face-to-face manner. This is really easy to avoid or shield yourself behind when you're on a screen or when it's digital. The easiest is to just not respond at all or say nothing, which means, you know, this person's really upset. I can shut my tablet, turn off my phone, and walk away. If we were in a face-to-face situation, you wouldn't just turn and walk away. In a lot of situations, I mean, think about that, right? When we were younger and this happened, we didn't just walk away most of the time.
That's right.
And the other piece of this is, how do we regulate our emotions in the moment? Again, if we see something online that's not pleasing to us, you know, we see things in the media all the time where, you know, people can hide behind the screen and express emotions that are really elevated or really escalated. Would someone be so quick to respond that way in person? Maybe not, but if they were, it certainly wouldn't be deemed socially acceptable. So when someone says something to us in the moment and we're face to face and it's uncomfortable, how do we regulate our emotions in the moment to respond appropriately? So that's another piece that is missing with social communication that I think is getting bypassed. And especially for this couple years that kids were not in school because of COVID, I mean, that shaved a couple years off of their social development too, with the little face-to-face contact that they did have in school and school-based activities. So it really, you know, decline is the key word here. Decline to what what we're used to and what face-to-face communication looks like and social problem solving. Yes, if we're looking at an AI world, that's all we're going to do is text and you know, instant message people, then maybe we're looking at rewiring our brains. I hope that's not the case, but it very well could be.
It's an amazing subject to talk about, and I know you have advice for parents to help their children to overcome this trend, but you know, it dawns on me that kids like this who have this problem, it's difficult to care for them, I would think. The parents become the caregivers, and the reason I mentioned that is you're writing a book, or have written a book on this whole subject, called From Exhausted to Energized, The Autism Spectrum Disorder Caregiver's Guide. That sounds amazing. Is in essence, is this a guide for parents to Yeah, and for others, not just parents, you know, to help people who suffer from this issue?
Yeah, one of the reasons that I actually wrote the book was I really didn't set out to write a book, like some people have. But I was, through my experience, I saw that there were a lot of self-help materials out there for caregivers. And the things and the tools that they focused on were really just didn't line up with this subpopulation's caregivers, meaning that the tools were either too difficult for them to use, and the fact that, you know, they just didn't have the time or couldn't have that much space to be able to engage in them. And I, you know, heard through my years of work with these parents that it was frustrating that, you know, they'd try to look at self-help tools, but they were just unrealistic for what they could accommodate with their situation with their child. And the other reason, and what I'm is that there are a lot of materials out there on ABA and the behavior. Okay, this is how you help your child. Yes, this is help for the parent, but it's help to teach the parent how to use behavior strategies. So there's a lot of that out there too. But what's different about the book and what I put together was let me teach you about ABA, but I'm going to teach you about it in the context of how you can build in your own self-care with this and why ABA is a step in the right direction of your own self-care. The key ingredient to this book for the caregiver and their self-care really is the energy psychology piece. And that's what really, I haven't found anything that's been written about this for this subpopulation. So I've been talking about it for years in presentations, and I thought, I'm just going to put this together. This has been so helpful for the parents that I've used this with in therapeutic settings that, you know, most parents who can't have access or can't seem to get their hands on access to quick help for them, this may be the tool that they need. And as far as the energy psychology techniques, I give a few concrete examples in the book that parents can do for themselves at home. And again, these are self-help tools that don't take an hour. They're not, you know, asking for them to get childcare so that they can leave the home for an extended period of time to decompress or go on a vacation or, you know, go out with friends, those types of things. These are things that you can shut yourself in the bathroom for a few minutes and just do. And most people do have the space for that. The other thing that I found through the years is that a lot of these kids are involved in so many auxiliary therapies. They might have physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy. And the parents choose, and rightly so, prioritize their time to be able to get their kids the help that they need. And then they say that they have little time for themselves. So it's hard for them sometimes to get to an outpatient session or to take an hour, again, of their time to, you know, have their own therapy a week. So for those that can't out there and haven't had any luck with traditional tools, this book is going to be a real big help for you. I also talk about the role of the parental emotions in this and where that can become a challenge when we implement the interventions for the kids. Like, this part would be useful for any parent because our emotions always come up when we're trying to deal with a problematic behavior because all of our kids have them, just some more than others. So I talk about the role of emotions and how this affects our energy, and having the right behavioral skills and tools can really help the parents' resiliency and building that stamina to have better days.
Well, I think the book, if you look at the book, the information on the book, this should be a great guide for parents of children who have ASD. Because as you point out, I mean, one of the chapters is dealing with the stress, urgency, and burnout for parents mm-hmm. and guardians that they have, mm-hmm. and that's a big issue. And that mm-hmm. and losing parental identity, that the caregivers lose that. What do you mean by that? They lose parental identity.
Well, a lot of people will say to me, I don't know who I am anymore other than Johnny's mom or Sarah's mom or Sarah's dad, you know. And so they become so entrenched because it is a whole different subpopulation. I can't say that enough. And you really have to be submerged in this, you know, idea of what this caregiving looks like for this subpopulation to understand. And it's a job that really never ends. I have parents that their kids are, again, grown in their 20s, and they still say to me, this job just doesn't And depending on the how profoundly affected that their child is with ASD, and again, there's a range, you know, it's like any other person. There's a lot of individual difference in how these individuals are affected. But, you know, they say that it's ongoing. So some parents, I think, look for milestones, right, with their kids that, oh, you know, once they hit this age, they'll be driving and they'll have a little bit more independence and I won't have to be running these places. Once they're 18, they'll go away to college. And these milestones don't always happen for the subpopulation. And the kids just have a new layer of skills and behaviors that need to be addressed as they age. So it really is a different type of parenting. It's all the time. These parents don't usually get a they'll say they don't get a vacation from off to autism. There's no vacations in autism. So it is a little, it's a lot more intense.
Well, I must tell you, the book, it sounds like a great book for parents who have children who've been diagnosed with this issue. Let me give out your website, Mandy. I think this is important because anybody who wants more information on you and your services or wants to find out more information on the book, obviously the book, by the way, I assume it's available on Amazon or at Barnes & Noble, stuff like that.
It's actually not out yet. It'll probably in the next year. Yep.
Oh,
we're just
next year.
Getting into the first
phases
of publishing. So, yeah.
Okay. Well, anyway, your website is Mandy Frieger. It's MandiFrieger.com. MandiFrieger.com. You know, one other thing, we learned there's another aspect to your services as a counselor that you call peak performance. Tell me a little bit about that in the minute or so we have left. Talk to me about that.
Well, peak performance is anyone who wants to attain their best performance, their best self. You know, how good do they want to be in whatever they're doing? So it could be, I just want to be better at my career. It could be, I want to be better in my daily life. I want to get better at my wellness to, again, the whole spectrum of athletic ability and athletes. And I'm working on a specific skill and I'm looking at the next level to my athletic development and how do I get there and how do I, you know, manage these thoughts when I'm, you know, performing another skill. So it can be a whole range of things. But what I like to say about counseling is I think that a lot of people think counseling is if I have a quote unquote problem or issue. And counseling doesn't have to be just about digging yourself out of the hole. It can be about getting better at whatever you're already doing. And there may be blocks to that we can help with in counseling, especially the energy psychology tools are great for these types of issues.
Well, it's an amazing story that you have to tell. And typically, how long do you work with a client? I guess it could go on for an extended period of time. Wouldn't that be right?
It depends. I think the ASD population, you know, this is sort of new territory for most clinicians about the longevity of outpatient service. Mm-hmm. And this is a lifelong diagnosis. And although people can develop skills, I'm finding that there, again, are different layers and there's new problems. And there's a lot of formulary thinking in this diagnosis, which means that, you know, I learned when this happens, but if there's a tweak or there's a difference in what occurs and I don't have the solution to that immediately available, I get stuck.
Yeah.
And so if you think about life, every situation is novel and new and that your next situation isn't exactly like the last one. So there are layers to this. And then the emotional regulation about what happens when I get stuck seems to be lifelong for many people diagnosed. So this population sometimes tends to stay.
Could be extended now.
Could be,
Mindy,
yeah.
Thank you so much. It's been great chatting with you. Mm-hmm. I'm so glad you came back again for another conversation. Mandy Frieger is our counselor's name. Again, her website is Mandi, Mandy Frieger, FrieGer.com. If you go there, you'll learn about her and how you can get in touch with her if you're interested. And you'll also learn a lot about her forthcoming book, which sounds like it should be a great help, especially for parents of children. Mandy, thank you very much. We appreciate it having
Thanks
you back.
Thanks for having me.
Listening to a broadcast from Close Up Radio, a division of Close Up Television, Incorporated. For more information about our show and to be considered for future broadcasts, please visit closeuptelevision.com. You may also learn about us on social media and listen to us on podcast and internet radio. Thank you for joining us, and we hope that you have an empowered and productive day.
We certainly do. I'm Doug Llewellyn, and that'll do it for today, everybody. Thank you very much. We'll see you next time. Till then, take care. Bye for now. You did a great job. I just wanted to let you know. Thank you so much. Okay? You're very welcome. All righty. Have a great day. Bye-bye.